133rd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 142 years to the day since Fred Spofforth took the first hat-trick in Test cricket. Welcome to the podcast that wishes it was nicknamed The Demon.
So as ever on Reverse Threat Radio, we're going to be talking about some of the latest happenings in the cricket world. We've been watching two pretty compelling Test series. And we're also going to be diving back into the history of the great game. I'm going to be talking about a Test match from 1953, a test match of tragedy and bravery. And we're also going to be reviewing a radio play, I think the first time we've ever reviewed a radio play on Reverse Threat Radio, called The Champion. But that's not all. It's really a jam-packed episode, and one of the highlights is that Andy has been chatting to Chris Smith, an old friend of the podcast from the Declaration Game blog. That's a really fascinating conversation coming up in just a minute. If you enjoy the podcast, please do hop over onto iTunes and leave us a review. Talking of reviews, Andy, you've been watching the New Zealand-Pakistan Test series. How have you been getting on with that?
Yeah, so it is at the perfect time for an English viewer. It's in that sort of just pre-bedtime slot. Mm. And I have to say, watching fans on the grassy slopes of Mount Maunganui, it's an incredibly appealing sight. Now, Pakistan fell just short of securing the draw in that first test, but it was still a triumph for Fawad Alam, who made a battling century on the final day. And there's been quite a bit of talk recently about the role of the short ball in cricket, and this has partly been prompted by the challenges of Australian batsman Will Pukowski, who's had repeated incidents of concussion. And I think there's been conversations about, you know, what is the appropriate place for the short ball. Mm. And I think the battle between Alam and Neil Wagner here was an example of just how much it matters to the game, and also just how much it can be mastered by a great batsman. Fifth day pitch, the bounce is erratic, and Fawad Alam's judgment was just superb, and it was quite a compelling thing to watch, actually. The thing that was sort of most extraordinary was he ducked with such confidence, and he was often getting sort of, you know, mere sort of inches beneath the ball, but he could do it because he knew where the ball was going. He had that confidence. We should say that Wagner, defying two broken toes, yes, to bowl with sort of energy and aggression, did finally get his man when a tired Alam gloved a shoulder-high delivery down the leg side late in the day. But it was a thrilling contest, but also a real example of how the short ball doesn't have to be feared. It can be conquered.
It can be conquered. And actually, as you say, that ducking can be a really positive step against the short ball as well, particularly if you've got a real sense of the pace of the pitch too, because with Alam it showed that he knew what the length and line was, but also that he had absolute trust that there wasn't one that was going to, you know, go slightly shorter bounce slightly lower than he would otherwise have thought. The compelling thing I thought about that match was that whenever I checked in on the scorecard, you know, sometimes he checks in and he went, oh, it's a done deal, clearly the game's going to end, you know, this way, usually with you know, New Zealand running away with it, and then you checked in half an hour later and it was completely, you know, almost completely flipped as well. So it's one of those really kind of compelling seesaw games.
Definitely. And I think also particularly nice for Fawad Alam, who I think has become known either as a slightly tragic figure because he had this very, very long wait to get back into the Test team, having made a lot of runs in domestic cricket. And then as a bit of a novelty figure because he has this extraordinary setup where he's kind of sort of fully front on.
Totally front on, yeah.
And I think ultimately nice for him to actually be talked about for his courage and skill rather than as some sort of kind of novelty attraction. Now, away from watching cricket, you have been doing some serious listening.
Yeah, so it's very rare that I actually get to be able to spend an entire day following, kind of dedicated to following a game of cricket, unless I'm actually at the ground itself, and then they're obviously their own kind of distractions when you're at the ground. But I ended up on an 11-hour drive on the day after Boxing Day from Christmas up in Brisbane back down to Sydney where I live. And we ended up actually listening to my partner and I, who those who listen to the podcast will know is not necessarily cricket's greatest fan, I think a tolerator rather than a fan. But we ended up basically listening to the entire day of the Australia-India game. And I suppose, wanted to just reflect on how engrossing that game was and how well set up it was, how all of the ingredients were there for a kind of classic test match. Firstly, the fact that India, obviously having collapsed horribly in Adelaide, had just been written off by everyone. Kohli had gone home. It felt like this was going to be, you know, a continuation of India's inability really to win in Australia that's been going on for decades now. But then also the debutants that came in. So Shubham Gill, the debutant for India, Cameron Green playing a second test for Australia, seeing how they went. And then I think the greatest story of all, which is Rahane stepping into Cody's massive shoes as captain, and also in that kind of pivotal place in the batting lineup. So there were all of these ingredients there. And suddenly I realized how great actually the radio can be. You know, we've all spent a lot of time lying under the bedsheets. You were kind of just describing it, Andy, with the New Zealand test, but, you know, lying under the bedsheets, listening to the cricket or watching the cricket. And I hadn't actually listened to a lot of cricket for a while, but suddenly the kind of total immersion you can get from listening to, you know, ABC Grandstand as it is here, is a really special way of suddenly in your mind's eye when you're on a long and boring drive going to the game. So it was amazing for me just to discover that beautiful kind of sense of, you know, being able to spend a long amount of time with a game of cricket on the radio.
Well, I was very upset with India in the first test because I woke up one morning determined to put the commentary on and sort of luxuriate in bed with it on in the background, only to find that it was the post-match interviews and the sort of post-mortem on the
India 36. It was gone too quickly.
They had disgracefully got out before I'd woken up. But I think it's this thing, isn't it, that, you know, Test cricket and all the four-day form of the game in the county game is something that it's a real rare luxury to be able to sort of see at length, isn't it? We normally spend our lives kind of dipping into it, dipping into it moments. So there does feel something very, very special, as you say, in being able to actually spend a day in its company.
To the interview, and for this episode, I've been speaking with Chris Smith, author of the Declaration Game blog. The Declaration Game ranges widely from personal experience and reflections on the game to statistical analysis. Chris has also been a great champion for cricket bloggers.
So since 2013, you've been pulling together a select 11 of the finest cricket blogging you found that year. And I've always been fascinated by the range of what's on the list, the range of sort of personalities, the types of writing. I just wondered if you could set out, what's your process for discovering and finding all these great writers and pieces of writing?
Well, I think the process is that process that gets criticized a lot in terms of why in society we're so polarized at the moment, which is this sort of echo chamber effect on Twitter. So I've over the years cultivated quite a wide range of cricket bloggers that I follow and follow me on Twitter, and I think what that does is it draws in more and more cricket blog material. And I think probably one of the things I did now 6 years ago that had a big impact was one of the projects I ran on Declaration Game was the cricket blogger survey. And I spent quite a bit of time going through other people's blog roles, not blog roles, blog roles where they're listing all the blogs that they like, and tried contacting lots of cricket writers to get them to take part in the survey. And I managed to get just over 100 to take part. And I think that has meant that I've had connections with lots of people around the world who write cricket blogs. And as I say, the Twitter algorithm, I think, then just keeps feeding in more material. I suppose on top of that as well, loosely, I think blogging is fairly collaborative. It's not deeply collaborative, but I think people who write cricket blogs will tend to be interested in finding a new one and recognise how important it is to give them some support through perhaps a retweet or a comment and something like that. So it all just ends up on the timeline. And I just take the time that when I see a new name, go and read a couple of pieces just to see what they're writing about, what might interest me. So it's probably as simple as that. It's a Twitter algorithm doing something good for once instead of...
It's really interesting to hear a sort of positive role for Twitter, because I love cricket Twitter, and yet I don't ever feel I've quite got the best out of it, in that I still find myself going through my feed and there's always more politics than I want there to be. And I mean, just to understand, I mean, are you quite, it sounds like you're quite open in terms of you'll follow as many, you'll follow a broad, or are you quite ruthless? Are you, I'm just kind of intrigued how you get the best out of it, because I feel I don't.
I am broad in terms of following people who write blogs and people who do podcasts like yourselves. I don't think I follow any cricketers. I follow a handful of journalists. So I have narrowed my focus onto people of a similar interest.
Yeah. And what tend to be, because I reading through this year's Select 11, and I sort of really mean this as a compliment, there isn't a sort of type, as far as I could see it. There isn't a sort of person with a style of writing who you go for particularly. I mean, could you pull out a strand? Do you think there's something that you tend to see in a writer that tends to pull you back to them, or is it a really just diverse series of attraction?
Yeah, diverse series of attraction. I think there are some themes, Andy. So I'm interested in stats. So, you know, I'll tend to have a few people writing with numbers who I'm following at any one time. Equally, you know, a nicely turned phrase, you know, can't beat that, can you? And there are plenty of people out there, fortunately, who write very attractively about cricket. An essence of blogging, I think, is personality and personal commitment. There's a lovely piece in there this year from a writer who calls himself the Grumbler, very personal about how at a crisis moment in his life, county cricket became so important to him. And that's the sort of piece that is always going to draw my eye, and I think will draw most people's eye, because our relationship with cricket is very personal and intense, and we can really empathise with some writing like that.
And it's and also some of those more personal pieces that have found homes in blogs that don't always find homes in other mediums. So,
absolutely, yes. I mean, that's where blogging has something distinctive to offer. And I like the sort of slightly off the wall piece. And again, this year there was a piece from an academic about his five favourite cricket books. And most of the piece was about why he doesn't actually like cricket very much, which I thought was really entertaining. So I managed to find a space for that one as well.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is you were sort of saying it's a collaborative endeavour. I mean, one thing I think that's a great service about the Select 11 is you're championing other people's writing. And I think that's really positive. I mean, it's something, you know, I hope that we can try and do in the podcast as well, because I think there's something really satisfying in being able to get writers who are not getting the attention they deserve out into the world a bit more. But I sort of wondered, given you mentioned the survey, given the amount of blogs you read, do you have a sense of how the world of cricket blogging has changed over the time you've been looking at it, kind of whether those changes have been for good or for ill, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so my sense is we're deep into a second phase of cricket blogging. So going back to the noughties when blogging started or became more popular, certainly in the UK, that was the first phase. And what you had there, I think, were a series of writers using the web and connecting through commenting on each other's blogs, coming to know each other through their blogs. And then we went into phase two, I think, at the start of the last decade, when blogging had to sort of coexist, sometimes positively, but not always positively, with social media. And I think that changed blogging a fair amount, and Twitter became central for cricket bloggers. We also got competition from the likes of yourself, in a way, in terms of podcasting. And I think there was a feel among some bloggers that blogging was probably going to start to erode as video and audio took over. That hasn't really happened. I think that the two recent things that I think are interesting, I've already mentioned statistics, and I think the quality of writing using data science techniques now is much, much better in some blogs than it is, for example, on Crick Info. I think Crick Info has really fallen quite a way behind in terms of analysis of cricket numbers. Obviously, you've got Crick Viz, which is very professional and very good. But outside of that, I would always look for a blogger in terms of analysis. And I think the other thing, very recent thing that's changed, Andy, that is interesting, is that we're starting to see the very successful writers being reader funded. So that's meant the likes of Jared Kimber, who of course is a is a big name and a really important person for our generation of writers and podcasters. He's now back blogging. He never gave up blogging, but he's now writing regularly. And that's because through Patreon, he's able to, and people are very happy to contribute to fund that work. King Cricket has done the same. King Cricket's one of the major figures in English cricket blogging, been going for years. And Alex was writing a lot for other websites a couple of years ago, but now is back writing on his own blog because he's getting that funded. So I think that's a really interesting move, and it shows that, and I've always been concerned that Crick Info, like the rest of the web, consolidates. So you get one major search engine, one major place for buying and selling books or whatever else. And Crick Info, I think, has had much the same effect in terms of cricket-dedicated web material. But I like this move so that very successful people who want to make a career and able to make a career out of it don't have to gravitate towards something like Crick Info. So I think that's a really positive move, particularly for younger writers who are looking to try and make a career doing this.
I mean, it's really interesting because there's now a lot of attention, and Jared's a great example of this, of the sort of Substack phenomenon, people sort of paying for newsletters, which is effectively blogs, right? It's very much the same thing. I mean, what I really wonder with Jared is I think he must be responsible for inspiring a huge number of bloggers. And if I'd love to get your sense of when you're reading writers, whether you see the split between the people who want to be the next Jared, who want to be this to be a profession, who want that sort of level of success and attention, and whether you see there's kind of a different tier of people who are actually, who love this, who it's a great passion for, but are not concerned about that scale of popularity. But I mean, do you feel they're sort of distinct categories of bloggers?
Yeah, I think they are, but overlapping. And that came out quite clearly. I mean, it's 6 years out of date now, but the survey I did, there were a small number of people who were into blogging because they saw it as a stepping stone, as it has been for some, as a stepping stone towards a paid career. It's only going to work for a small number of people because paid cricket writing isn't that big an industry. The majority of us are going to be hobbyists and are just happy to write for the pleasure of being able to express ourselves and get some feedback from it. And I think the two can coexist very successfully.
And you must have seen, and you know, it's a great frustration, I guess, for all of us, that you sometimes get onto a blog you really enjoy or a podcast you really enjoy, and then it goes quiet. And you must know, you know, from your, you know, extensive experience as both a blogger and a reader, and I feel I now know as a podcaster that there are so many good reasons for that. I always appreciate that someone will, you know, fall out of love with it or other things in life take over. But do you have any sense of what is it that sets apart the bloggers who you've been reading for a long time, the ones who just who keep going year after year producing good stuff?
I think one of the things that distinguishes them, I'm thinking of people like King Cricket and Backwatersman, who writes Crumbs and Rambler, but they have a very distinctive voice. They've found a way of expressing themselves which is consistent. It might rove across different cricket areas, but they've really developed something that is quite individual. And I think their readers appreciate that. The readers know sort of what they're going to get when they get there, and they're managing to deliver that regularly and successfully. So I think there's something to do with that. I a little while ago, when I last spoke with the podcast with Toby, I also talked about the other blog I was doing at the time, which was Touchline Gag, which I'm not doing now. And while I was doing that, I did actually do a bit of blog training with a successful professional writer. And one of the things he said to me was, you need to develop a voice. And it made complete sense to me because I could see what people like King Cricket had done. But it just didn't interest me. I wanted to be able to write about numbers one day and writing the voice of a seven-year-old playing their first game of cricket another day. So I think that that's a sort of a dilemma that anybody writing needs to resolve themselves, whether or not they want to go down a particular channel and be recognisable for it, or write whatever they want, which is what some of us choose to do. And I think in terms of the voice, I think that's something that you and Toby have done with your podcast. You've really created a voice and a structure for your podcast that works.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think it's interesting. We've always thought a lot about the idea of not trying to do what is done elsewhere. So I think obviously we can never compete with a professional team who can do, you know, a daily podcast on what happened today. So I wonder if there's that parallel with podcasting and blogging about trying to see what you can do that maybe professionals can't. I just wanted to come back to the data point, because I similarly would completely agree that I find the really interesting innovative data science writing to be on blogs rather than on Crick Info, etc. I'm just trying to think why that is. I mean, is there a reason why Crick Info, maybe it will happen, but why haven't they got after some of these, you know, people and said, look, come and write for us? I mean, do you think that's maybe down the still to come?
Yeah, I suspect it is. Crick Info innovated with Stats Guru, but Stats Guru hasn't really changed now in, I would guess, 7 or 8 years, which is quite surprising. The other thing that Crick Info did a few years ago, I think both you and I, Andy, I think we've both been published on Crick Info, because they used to have a, I can't remember what it was called, but they had a page area where they would publish amateur writers. They've, quite understandably, I think, they've cut all that out now. They've streamlined what they publish. And I think with that streamlining, perhaps they've missed the opportunity to engage with the data science cricket writing community. That would be my speculation.
You're absolutely right. And I'd love to know the logic behind that, because I mean, I, like you, it was a nice thing to get published on Crick Info. You know, it was a great way to get readers and some listeners. And I was sort of writing some stuff during lockdown, and I got some stuff published via Vox Cricket, which has been quite a fun project that's sort of now been put on hold, but was sort of done. And I sort of went to Crick Info, and I thought, actually, opportunity has gone, which is, I guess, an interesting editorial decision on their part. You've obviously got this other hat in terms of your involvement in cricket, well, several hats, as coach and also father to young cricketers. When you were last on the podcast, a mere 7 years ago, you and Toby talked about this idea of your concerns. How do we get people into clubs, like, you know, I guess at all stages, but particularly at younger players? I mean, 7 years on, are you more optimistic, less optimistic? How do you feel that sort of, how do you feel about the health of cricket clubs?
Well, and if we could take away the pandemic, I think that the health is actually not too bad. We don't yet know what effect the pandemic will have. Very fortunately, cricket fell into a sweet spot last summer after the first wave and before the second wave, and managed to have a bit of a season, which is great, because it meant that everybody committed to cricket was able to play again in 2020, and it wasn't a complete blank. So if we take the pandemic away, I think I'm no less negative than I was 7 years ago. And my fears about being able to find junior cricketers, certainly from my own local experience, I live in the South Manchester suburbs, and our junior section is thriving. It's as strong as it's ever been. When I look at the new players we recruit, I'm conscious that there are two themes. The first is that they tend to be related to someone already at the club, a dad, an uncle, or an older brother or sister. And the second, I think, very positive, the second one is that we've integrated very well with our local Asian communities. And so that's been fantastic for the club in terms of its position locally and other clubs. Like, it's not just my club, Sale Cricket Club, that's managed to do that. So those two factors mean that we continue to recruit good numbers of juniors. We're also seeing the impact of the ECB taking a much more directive role in junior cricket, which I hadn't anticipated 7 years ago. So about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, they introduced all-stars cricket for under nines. And this year they were due to, sorry, last year, 2020, they were due to introduce dynamos cricket for 9 to 11 year olds. And so that was a way that cricket would have a web platform nationally, cricket clubs would have a web platform nationally to recruit youngsters who would then go through a quite structured 8-week program of coaching. And that's been relatively successful. It's ruffled some feathers in clubs who wanted to recruit themselves, But I think that that's to play out. I don't quite know where that's going to go, Andy, to be honest. I think all of us who've been coaching kids for a long time bridled a bit at the centre telling us how to do it. But they have offered something in terms of the structure and providing kids with kit, which is great.
From the archives, now we've all been enjoying the recent procession of Boxing Day test matches, and this prompted Toby to look back to previous great games. We're going back to 1953. It's a game we've looked at before, back in Reverse Sweat Radio 95, but it is a story so moving and so powerful that we thought this was a good opportunity to take another look.
So we're at Ellis Park, Johannesburg. It's the second test of the series between South Africa and New Zealand. The New Zealand test side has been going for a couple of decades at this point, but they are still winless after 27 tests. And the first test in the series has proven that they're underdogs. They've been defeated by an innings. But the second test is, I think, one of the remarkable stories in cricket, which is why, you know, a good story is worth telling twice, and here we are telling it the second time on Reverse Sweat Radio. So it's a test that actually started on Christmas Eve. Back in the day, they decided that actually starting tests on Christmas Eve was a good idea before you then went into a rest day on Christmas Day, and presumably, you know, whoever drank less champagne before lunch on the Christmas Day came out better in the second half of the match.
It's always struck me as a fascinating thing, the rest day, and maybe it's something we should do from the archives on at one point, but this idea that you could finish as a batsman and then have to go for your Christmas festivities and then go back on Boxing Day all ready to go is quite a strange demand. On
98 not out on Christmas Day kind of situation.
Exactly, yeah.
So South Africa go into Christmas Day at 259 for 8. They can be fairly happy. It's on a pretty bowler-friendly wicket. Now, what happens on Christmas Day is that there's a huge rail tragedy in New Zealand. So the Whanganui River had a bridge over it which collapsed, taking with it a passenger train, killing 151 people. And so the New Zealand cricket team wake up on Boxing Day morning as the test is resuming to hear the news. And they discover that one of the dead is Nerissa Love, who is the fiancé of their opening bowler, Bob Blair, the 21-year-old Bob Blair. The other thing to note is that they don't actually have a complete list of the dead at this point, so they don't actually know whether any of the other people are relatives of the team. So the whole, you know, this is something that really hangs heavy over the whole team. They decide to resume the match. Bob Blair doesn't continue playing. He stays at the team hotel with the team manager, putting a consoling arm around him. But the rest of the New Zealand team decide that they're going to go back and play with the flags at half mast to continue the test.
So this is one of the worst rail tragedies sort of anywhere, and it by having a look at this, it appears to be by far the worst in New Zealand's history. I think what must have been extraordinary for the players is this pressure as well, perhaps, to be seen to offer something to the country in terms of entertainment,
yes,
in terms of something uplifting at a time of national tragedy. I mean, I think this is something that we see put on sportsmen actually from time to time, that when a country's at its lowest, you look to sportsmen somehow.
To be your heroes.
What a burden. Exactly, but what a burden to have to carry, especially when there is that personal involvement as well.
And especially when you are facing Neil Adcock, the South African opening bowler, on a spicy pitch as well. He rapidly reduces the New Zealanders to 9 for 2, so their openers go very quickly. Then the New Zealand number 4, Bert Sutcliffe, comes to the wicket. He reminiscing on the game, he comes up with this beautifully understated line, which is, he says, from Adcock's first over, "It was clear that we were in for a warm time." I love the idea of, you know, bouncers whistling past your ear as being a warm time. And actually, a couple of overs later, he tries to hook a quick bouncer from Adcock, and the ball hits him in the ear. He's knocked unconscious instantly, and there's blood all over the pitch. he comes round, but he's taken off to hospital. But he makes a point of shaking the South African captain's hand before he leaves the pitch to say, you know, no hard feelings here. We realise that this is sort of all fair in love and war. It's clear that the South Africans are not going to go easy on the New Zealanders, despite the fact that, you know, close friends and relatives have been just killed in a rail tragedy. And Laurie Miller, the New Zealand number five, comes in. Is hit on the chest, starts coughing up blood. He also is packed off to hospital. So at this point, the New Zealand team are down one player back at the hotel, grieving for a dead fiance, and two players in hospital. It's really looking bright for the Kiwis at this point.
The handshake is completely fascinating, and I think I wonder if I would guess not, but I wonder if any visual evidence remains of it. I wonder if, as you say, part of it is a no hard feelings thing, but I wonder if there isn't also a certain defiance in that as well.
Yes, exactly.
To say,
exactly.
You know, I've still
yep,
got.
I'm all right. I'm still here.
Exactly.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep. I've still got the kind of wherewithal to be able to stand up and shake your hands. Now, look, after this, stuff does start getting really, really interesting. So, Miller comes back into the middle. Miller, who's previously been, you know, coughing up blood after being hit on the chest, he comes back into the middle against doctor's orders. New Zealand, though, are a long way off their follow-on target, and when Miller's out, it's expected that the New Zealand number 11, a fairly hopeless batsman by the name of Tony McGibbon, will be coming to the crease. Instead, this kind of apparition emerges from the pavilion. It's a figure with a heavily bandaged head, and it is none other than Bert Sutcliffe. And apparently, as he walked to the crease, blood started trickling, you know, sort of saturating the bandage and trickling down his neck. But he does make his way to the crease. As he admits, again, afterwards, there's quite an interesting interview with him, and he admits that he was, quotes, fortified by a generous helping of Scotland's chief product, and I don't mean porridge. So there he is, Dutch courage in his veins.
There is a write-up of this game that suggests that actually Sutcliffe never really had confidence against the bouncer ever again after this.
Yep.
And I mean, that is a feature of, it's not an uncommon feature of batsman's career where they suffer a blow like this and they never really get rid of that fear. But I think there's something extraordinary in the moment to be able to willingly say, I'm going to face that again. I'm going to voluntarily choose to
and again
to
I do
confront this.
Wonder whether it does exactly as you say come down to this sense of, with this awful tragedy that has happened at home, what is a blow to a head to the cricket ball to me? You know, shouldn't I just get on with it and get out there and play for a bit of national pride? So he decides that it's no moment to be blocking, to be playing forward defensive shots, and he hits a series of boundaries that takes New Zealand past the follow-on mark. South Africa take the final two wickets, and then they start, you know, heading into the pavilion in anticipation of then the innings ending and them coming out to bat. But then perhaps the most unexpected part of this innings happens, and Bob Blair, from his hotel room, has made his way independently to the ground. He's heard on the radio about New Zealand being a long way behind in their first innings. And as he comes out to the crease, he meets Bert Sutcliffe, the other not-out batsman, and he says to him, I'd like to feel I can help. Apparently, at the moment that Bob Blair comes out, the crowd, everyone in the crowd is aware of the context here, and you can hear a pin drop. The New Zealand writer Dick Brittenden said, looking down on the scene from the glass windows of the pavilion, the New Zealanders wept openly and without shame. The South Africans were in little better state, and Sutcliffe was just as obviously distressed. Before he faced his first ball, Blair passed his glove across his eyes in the heart-wringing gesture of any small boy anywhere in trouble but defiant. And so here you have a series, two cricketing teams just reduced to tears and a crowd that can't say a word.
The courage of the New Zealanders is clear, but I think it is interesting to look at the role of the South African team here. I mean, you made the point earlier that they were clearly competitive, they were clearly fired up for it, as they should be. You know, this is you have to compete, you have to do your best in the game. But I think at this stage, it must become really, really challenging, you know, because at this point, you sort of feel like the bit part players in a story that has a significance far beyond the game. And I wonder how you do actually stand at the top of your mark and think, you know,
totally,
I'm going to put six balls where I want them.
Yep, exactly, exactly. Eight balls, actually. Eight ball overs during game. There's a just to pick you up on a piece of really nerdy trivia there. Sutcliffe is there in the middle. He's the not out. He's the not out batsman, and Miller has come out to join him. They go on the rampage together. They add 33 runs in 10 minutes, including, I believe, breaking the record for the most number of runs off an eight ball over at that point in Test cricket. I think they score 26 off an over or something at one point as well. And when the innings ends, they walk to from the wicket back to the pavilion with their arms around one another. Again, apparently to a completely empty stadium. A completely silent stadium. The spectators just don't know how to respond to this. Ultimately, it's not enough. New Zealand end up losing the game by 100 runs. They're chasing 230 in their second innings. But actually, the result of the game isn't the reason, obviously, that you remember this. The reason you remember it is because it's just one of these astonishing moments of cricketing fortitude. You know, a Christmas test that we always think of cricket at this time of year as being a bit of a sort of festival, a bit of a sort of carnival appearance. But suddenly, here was a game that obviously took on so much more meaning beyond just the cricket that was happening on the pitch at the time. The review, and for this episode, we have been listening to The Champion, which is a radio play about the life of W.G. Grace, made in 1993.
So it was written by Martin Worth, who was a prolific writer of radio plays. He also penned the BBC's original Poldark adaptation back in 1975. Timothy Spall stars as Dr. Grace, so that is a pretty serious front man. It's a 90-minute play. It covers the entirety of Grace's life, and it does that for the most part in kind of snippets. So we have sort of scenes from different eras sort of patched together, a kind of bit of a collage of a life, and tries to cover everything really from the personal to the cricketing. Any attempt to, and I was thinking about this, you know, we read a lot about cricket, obviously, for the podcast, watch a fair bit, but actually we haven't covered much of what you'd call historical fiction about the game, which is what this is. The challenge with historical fiction: how do you bring a real life historical figure to life? How does this play succeed or fail on that?
So I often feel that for a kind of fictionalized account of history to make you feel closer to the events and feel like you've learned something, they need to make it somehow feel contemporary, as if you can relate to the people and as if you're, you know, not seeing them as something in a glass case as a museum, but something that's happening, you know, that could be a part of your world. And it was a bit of an issue for me that this radio play very much felt like it put up a bit of a barrier and a bit of a distance between us in the 21st century, although obviously this was made in the 20th century, and the events that it's describing. I mean, that goes all the way down to the kind of slightly ludicrous West Country accent that W.G. Grace has throughout it.
So the portrayal of Grace is ludicrously energetic, self-obsessed, and does feel a bit cartoonish. I guess the one thing I would say for both Spall and the playwright is that that is often how Grace is portrayed. And I think I sort of agree with you that he's a bit implausible, but then the way Grace is written about so often is a myth. And in some ways, the portrayal feels quite true to that myth. I think for those of us who know some of the well-worn anecdotes, there's that sort of moment. There are those moments of familiarity. So you get his skullduggery continuing to run while the ball is stuck in his shirt being a particularly good moment.
Yep. And the statement about they've come to see me bat, not you bowl.
Yes,
as well, those kind of moments very much become a part of it.
Exactly. And I guess on the personal side, it's interesting to see what's focused on. So I confess I had either forgotten or never known this point about his closeness to his mum, which the play brings up very clearly. There's also this desperation for particularly his son Bertie to follow in his footsteps, and I think that's rather well done. I mean, this isn't generally a very subtle play. It's everything is done. It's a little bit blatant and at times a bit ham-fisted, but the bit when Bertie is batting with his dad for the MCC and is clearly miserable about the whole thing, overshadowed by his hero father, is quite well done.
And I agree with you that there that what that was one of the things that was that I suppose I sort of learned from this was putting Grace into the context of his family, because we know that he came from, you know, his siblings were and his brothers were doctors and also some of them quite fine cricketers too. But I was interested to see, as you say, the relationship with the mother, which is kind of slightly bizarre at times, you know, the situation where she's telling him, you know, not to play across the line and telling him off because he's done that. Also then his courtship of his cousin, who he then goes on to who he then goes on to marry. And yes, the dialogue that's presented in the play is quite ham-fisted, but what you do get through that is a sense of a human being, the man behind the beard, I suppose.
And there's an attempt as well, so we get that more personal side. And it's funny when you say courtship of his cousin; it's a Grace style courtship. It's pretty pretty direct and unromantic. But there's also this sense that the playwright wants to look about Grace's role in society as a whole, and there's this view put forward that maybe unwittingly he was used, and this view that he was actually people in positions of power, members of the aristocracy, kind of used him for their benefit. I don't know if the play ever kind of thrashes that out in full, and maybe you'd argue it's not the job of a play too. It sort of hints at it and brings it out. But the play finishes with sort of a kind of scene of Grace reflecting on his own role and sort of having kind of moments of self-doubt. Again, not quite sure how plausible it is, but I think an interesting attempt by the playwright to think of Grace in the wider context.
I think also,
what about the wider game? I mean, that's the other side of it, I guess. This is a play about Grace, but it's also a play about cricket.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about what the audience for this play might be, because there is quite a lot of time spent putting down the groundwork in terms of explaining what the difference between amateurs and professionals are in cricket, for instance. And so I think the playwright feels a responsibility to set up some of that context for his audience, and therefore I kind of found it hard to know whether when, for instance, there was a discussion about the importance of the game between the players and the gentlemen, and it's discussed between two characters in the play that it's the reason why England has never had a revolution, because this is the moment when the players can express their, you know, let out their feelings and their anger through the medium of cricket towards, you know, their employers, as it were, and that therefore they don't need to do it with guns in the streets via revolution. I don't know how far that is the playwright simply extrapolating a general view on the idea of amateurism in cricket, or how much it's actually something that's related to cricket specifically during the time that that Grace was playing. So it's kind of hard to know how far to treat any of that as kind of historical evidence, I suppose.
I think that, I mean, your point about the audience was one I pondered on as well, which is, I mean, we obviously know a reasonable bit about cricketing history, and I thought there were moments when I was sort of scurrying to catch up a bit and be like, hang on, who's this? And I did wonder actually whether it might not be quite hard work, frankly, for someone who's not familiar with the game. I think there's this interesting thought about whether Grace's willingness to embrace the business side of his game and not think perhaps about the broader consequences. That to me actually felt like quite an interesting modern observation.
Yep, totally.
There's exactly those thoughts today about, you know, what are the obligations of a professional sportsman?
Yep.
Is it okay for a professional sportsman to say, my job is to score runs, score goals, make as much money as I can, or do you have a broader responsibility?
And in 1993, that would have been absolutely a key question that was facing the game at that point. You know, that is something that, and that's why I suppose I found it slightly disappointing that I felt that the play was so set up the events as being so other, you know, as being so oldie worldy and so different. If you just had even just the difference of just having people speaking normally, I think would have helped that comparison to come out, rather than feeling like it was something that was happening so much in the far distant past.
There are some curious sort of moments. The tour for Australia is, yes, it captures quite well this idea of Grace making plenty of money, but also being made to work for it. So it's trekking all over the country, and his heavily pregnant new wife coming with him.
Yep.
We have Australians not knowing what a roller is. That was a good moment.
Yeah, and then they go out into the village and find the person with the biggest feet and ask them to tram down the wicket. Again, one wonders how historically accurate that might be, but it's certainly good fun. You know, when you think of those kind of late 19th century, and maybe this is therefore quite true to the time, those late 19th century kind of caricatures, you get them on cigarette cards and, you know, those sort of sketches, cartoons almost. It sort of feels like that a little bit, the way that it describes W.G. Grace. It's described in the manner of his time, I suppose.
I think you've got a playwright here who has done his homework, who has absolutely researched, who knows the great stories about Grace, and has put together something that I think is absolutely entertaining, and I think particularly cricket fans will sort of sit down and find moments to enjoy. But it's perhaps not something that, in the way that sort of great fiction or great drama kind of hits quite deep and sort of stays with you, I don't think that this is sort of something fun that you will listen to and move on from.
So that is The Champion. You can find it on YouTube. I think that's where we
found
it.
That's right, yeah.
Yep, we'll tweet out a link to it. And that was the 133rd episode of Reverse Ripped Radio. You can hear us wherever you find your podcast. We're over on Spotify, by the way. You can find us there as well if that is where you listen. Thank you for joining us. We will be back in a few weeks' time.